extra time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Get lost. Get lost.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here.
Oh, from New York, New York, you are listening to Extra Time. I'm Andrew Wiebe with my partner in soccer. It's Matt Doyle Monday. We're breaking down Match Day 9, the best thing we saw coming right up. One of the best, worst sitcoms of all time made an appearance in MLS. Patrick Mahomes was around as well, including some sick shades that we'll talk about. Plus, there's a new stadium in Queens. ETR's man of the match day is who? Well, somebody from Inter Miami. We'll tell you who in just a little bit. Plus, oh, Canada, Caps Galaxy, and Montreal Cincy, two of the best games from the weekend. We'll break those down. Talk about Evander's spot in the number 10 hierarchy in Major League Soccer. Name our current coach of the year favorite. And of course, hand out the wackest award in Major League Soccer. Who's whack? Who isn't whack at this point? San Jose, Dallas, the Revs, Emmanuel Reynoso. They're all in the running and in the mailbag. We'll tell you how much MLS has improved in the last 15 years. Anders, meanwhile, swears we will never get to that point. So we will see, producing Anders. Doyle, what's up, man? How's it going?
When we hand out the weekly That's Whack Award, do we owe royalties to Charlie Davies? Is that
we don't.
We don't?
Okay. We don't. We don't say those things out loud. I thought that was understood. That we
congrats. Like, congrats to Charlie and Alexis and our good friend Susanna and Nico and, of course, Chris Karen behind the scenes and everyone at CBS Galazzo for a year. They just had their anniversary, I think, late last week. It's fantastic. The coverage they've been able to provide, not just of MLS, but of everything overseas as well. We're so happy and proud of all those folks.
Yeah, absolutely. I would throw a bunch of names in there, but at this point, I don't have the list put together. It would be in my wheelhouse. I'll just say, look, survive another decade or maybe 15 years and be right where Extra Time is. you'll have measured up to our longevity. So no, I'm just kidding. Congratulations to everybody involved. It's been awesome to see that project start and then just gain momentum and build and build and build. Soccer is in a good place, we think, around here. How about the best thing you saw, Doyle? Get us started. Match Day 9 was a fun one. What are you thinking about?
Jim Curtin's post-game presser. Not a fan of CBS programming. What does clear and obvious even mean is what Jim Curtin said. What's clear and obvious to me might not be to the next human. Millions of people watch 2.5 Men, and I think it's the dumbest show ever. It's clear and obvious to me that it's terrible.
That's great.
That's just all right.
Did that come up in the moment? Like, you know, that's like a yes and sort of, you know, improv moment from Jim Curtin on the dais right there.
Or it could have just been like stewing on it for years and years.
Yes.
And finally, he had his moment to take a swing. Does obviously strike me as an Always Sunny type of guy.
Stewing on what? On the idea of clear and obvious or the idea of 2.5 Men being a terrible show?
Both. I think it's yeah, both. I think it's pretty clear he doesn't like the terminology clear and obvious. I actually think it's good. I like the idea of having that delineate and inform what gets overturned and what's not. I know because you do instant replay every week, you deal in this sort of thing quite a bit.
Yeah, and the dark arts. No, I'm just kidding. Not the dark arts. But I like it, too. I think the issue is not with the terminology. It's with the interpretation of that terminology by different people. And not so much in the sense of what is clear and obvious, like the term, but what is clear and obvious when you watch a play. Like, and that comes down to a lot of things. It comes down to perspective, both in terms of where your rooting interest is, if my mentions are to be trusted on any Sunday night, but also in terms of what's the camera angle you have. What is the empirical proof that you're working with, the evidence? For different people, clear and obvious is going to mean different things in those situations. And then also interpretation of the laws. Like, I mean, I am as versed in those laws as any layman could probably be. I would argue a non-referee, because look, professional or amateur referees got this stuff down pat. They're the experts in that sense. But that those laws can be interpreted, and they are not always written in a black and white way. So when you hit that clear and obvious, there's just so many factors that go into it. And before we move on to what the best thing I saw, this game had so many of those moments. Like, I'm just going to run you through right now. Is it clear and obvious to you, offside or onside, for Mikel Uwe on the game-winning goal that was deemed offside on the field? What do you think should have happened in that situation?
I thought he was onside.
I have no idea. It's one way or it's the other, but I do think the flag should have stayed down.
Okay.
I think in that borderline situation, based on everything I know, everything I've watched and been told, I think the flag should stay down.
And then if it had stayed down, it would have stood.
Yes, because the VAR would not have had any clear and obvious evidence to the contrary. Now, the flip side of this is none of us have the best angle. We can both admit that the angle we see on the broadcast is not perfect in any way. It's not like we're looking down that line saying, bang, right there. I see even, I don't see daylight, whatever it is, we have the camera on the right spot. That's not the case. Catherine Nesbitt, the AR, is in the right spot. Her positioning on this play is good. So there's two ways to think about it. Would I like to see the flag go stay down? Yes, because I think it's close. But I'm also not standing in the spot that she is. I don't have that angle. And if Catherine Nesbitt looks down that line and her brain tells her, she's a great AR, by the way, that is clearly and obviously offside, and not clearly and obviously, that she is sure that that's offside, then make the call. But at the same time, maybe keep the flag down and then bring it up at the, it's tough. It's a game of inches, centimeters, whatever convention you have in whatever part of the world that you live in. I will say that the tears from Atlanta fans about the throw-in that led to the Kai Wagner goal, those are whack.
I mean, that one
that's weak.
That was clearly and obviously a legal throw. It is. I looked at your mentions, Weeby, and I honestly think that a lot of those Atlanta fans are only crying because they saw all the Philadelphia fans crying, and they were like, "Hey, we have to be aggrieved too."
Yeah, yeah. It's like, you know, it's like babies in the daycare center. If one cries and gets attention, the next one is going to inevitably cry. You know, it's cause and effect relationship in that sense. Here's a question for you. Better result for Philly, a 2-2 draw on Sunday, or a worse result for Atlanta at home?
I think it's better result for Philly because you come back from 2-0 down and you get a road point. With Atlanta, you could say, okay, we were missing a bunch of our starting, both starting center backs were out. Yakumakis was out. Jonte Silva was out. Like that's a lot. The flip side is you blew a 2-0 lead and you were lucky that you got away with the point. I wrote in my column that this game ended up being one of the ones where both teams' flaws were kind of like screaming at me as opposed to both teams' virtues. This was Atlanta figuring out a way to fall apart. This was Philadelphia being kind of soft along the back line in a way that they haven't been forever. And obviously Andre Blake getting hurt again is a massive concern because the drop off between even 80% Andre Blake and their current crop of backup keepers is pretty substantial. So it ended up being sort of a big, bright warning sign for both teams.
Interesting. Andre Blake is one that is starting to get concerning. This is another game where he leaves mid-game and the injuries just seem to be circulating around him. We hope he gets healthy and stays healthy because he's one of the best players in the league, one of the most entertaining goalkeepers we have in Major League Soccer when it comes to doing what goalkeepers do, preventing goals. Best thing I saw, well, first of all, congratulations, Johnny and Nadine Russell, I assume, on the birth of their daughter, Stevie. Dad Hive is absolutely buzzing about this one. I will celebrate any birth, any happiness within any family around the world, and Johnny seems to be in a good moment for him. Not so good for Kansas City. I'll get to that in a second. One, speaking of Hives buzzing, Patrick Agyeman Hive, we back, baby. Make the near post run, Patrick. Don't worry about all these flubbed finishes and poor footwork around the box in big goal-scoring situations. Just make the near post run. Let your physicality stand out, your instincts in the box. We know you have those. He also drew a red card or a second yellow in Charlotte's win at home. Now that's 13 unbeaten straight at home in the Queen City for them. So congratulations to Patrick Agyeman. Got a little bit of a, got the pressure off him just a tad with that goal. And then, of course, what an incredible night for soccer in Kansas City on Saturday. I was saying it from the jump. We were on MLS Countdown, the pregame show, and they just kept showing all these images of Messi fans in the stadium. And I was like, guys, I'm getting text messages from my family, from my friends, from all sorts of people I know who are there. And they're all saying, there is blue everywhere, that Sporting fans have come out in mass. And when you looked at the stadium and 72,000 plus people being there, it wasn't a pink out in any way. Like, you had to search to find those people. It was Kansas City fans rooting for their team. Now, that part didn't exactly work out, but it was Kansas City in every way. The parking lots opened at 3 p.m., people everywhere, smoked meats in the air, brown liquor in glasses, and I'm sure other drinks as well, and soccer balls on the ground. Like, the word I was getting was that there were basically pickup games happening. You know, you go tailgate, you need something to do. Put a soccer ball down. It's like one of the best tailgating activities, in my opinion, as long as you got a little bit of technical ability and you're not ruining other people's days. But that just sounds like the perfect afternoon to me. Go post up at Arrowhead Stadium.
Those burnt ends, man.
No, you don't. Not in Kansas City. Are you kidding me? You don't got to earn anything in Kansas City when it comes to barbecue. You just take it, and if you fall asleep or gain 15 pounds, that's part of the culture. That's just the way it works. But that's a perfect day. For me, you go to the stadium, you tailgate, you're around this massive community of soccer fans of different stripes, you would assume, meet people, have a good time, go into the stadium. It's completely full. It's packed in a way that, you know, the Chiefs sort of have hegemony on in Kansas City. Like, it's our stadium, our place. But then you remember the history. You think back to the days of the KC Wiz and then the Kansas City Wizards playing there. You think about the Manchester United friendly in 2010 and 54,000 people who packed that stadium and then changed sort of the fate of professional soccer in Kansas City. Now add 18,000 more people, add the GOAT, Lionel Messi, add a banger from Messi as well that those fans get to witness. Of course, disappointment because the home team once again blew an opportunity, but man, what a day that had to be for all the people that were in attendance. And what a day it had to be for Patrick Mahomes, Sporting Kansas City owner, who was wearing the haters can't see me sunglasses and told Lionel Messi, quote, have fun out there. I know it was a throwaway line, Doyle, but when I saw that clip leading up to the game, I was like, oh no, don't tell Lionel Messi to have fun. He's liable to do it against you.
I mean, what would you say in that situation? It's an awkward made-for-TV situation against a guy who you're not sure how much English he has.
What would you say? So you got to keep the messaging simple. I think I would stick with something just like, hey, really respect you and love watching you play. That's different than saying go have fun, right?
Oh, that's natural. That's
really, hey, it's from the, you know, from the football goat to the football goat saying, hey, I respect you a ton, man.
All right.
Happy you're
here. I don't know. I didn't have any problem with him saying go have fun out there.
No, me either. But I just thought it was funny because he said it and then Messi did it, an assist and a goal. And the last thing on my list is New York City FC. We've talked about it. The stadium is now approved. History is going to be made at Willets Point. It looks amazing. The Cube, whatever they end up calling it, right in the shadow of Arthur Ashe Stadium in Citi Field, the site of a famous Kansas City Royals World Series victory. That's just going to be one of the best places in the world, I would argue, to watch soccer, in the most diverse place in the world, in Queens, New York. To build it there in what is very accessible from a public transport situation, whether it is the 7 train coming in or LAR coming the other way, and just a place that lives and breathes sporting history. It's going to be really special. So I'm looking forward to, I think, 2027, right?
That coming in? That is the target date, yeah. Yep.
You're on the 7 train, Doyle.
I am right on the 7 train. I am I'm trying to contain my excitement because it is a couple years down the road. So I'm going to give it a little bit of time. But once it starts going up, once we start seeing like the superstructure of the stadium get built, well, I'll tell you what, we're going to definitely grab a bunch of folks together and do a food crawl through Flushing, get our way to Willets Point, because like the best Asian food outside of Asia, I swear it exists in Flushing. It's incredible.
Best fill in the blank food outside of anywhere in New York City and certainly in Queens. All right, let's dig in a little bit. Extra Time's Man of the Match Day. Pick your Inter Miami player with a goal and an assist. Is it 1, Diego Gomez, or 2, Lionel Messi? Doyle.
I'm going to go with Lionel Messi, though.
Oh, good. Interesting. Yeah. Interesting.
Diego Gomez had himself quite a day, and he has been as advertised. It took him a while to live up to the expectations that he brought with him when he was signed last summer. I thought he struggled his first dozen games or so, but he's been excellent this year, whether he's been playing in midfield or on the wing. But Messi is just, the goal was great, the pass. And I know you're about to say, oh, Kansas City, you know, gave him too much space and you got to go with him and have a plan to blow. And you're right, right? You should always bracket Messi. But that pass even surprised Luis Suarez. If you go back and you watch the clip of the pass, Luis Suarez thinks that Messi just mishit the pass. And it takes him a second to react to it and realize that there's a run coming from Gomez behind him. It was an absurd pass. It was the type of play that, I'm not going to say only Messi makes, but only Messi makes that play seem regular or normal. And it's, I mean, it's why he's the, that more than the goal scoring is why he's the greatest who's ever played soccer. And it's why I picked them to win the Shield and MLS Cup and why I think they'll do it.
The interesting thing to me, watching other players play with Messi, we've talked a lot about a tendency to feel, okay, we'll just get the ball to Messi's feet, and sometimes overplaying to Messi and forcing it in there, if you can even do that. It seems like sometimes you can. The second one is clearly quickly understanding that Messi's vision and ability to execute on that vision quickly and with precision is at such a different level that you should just make runs that you would not normally make. And so in that play, you give credit to Messi for the pass and for the vision and for, you know, understanding where that play is going. But that play is never going there without Diego Gomez from a deep position, seeing Messi get on the ball in that situation and being like, I have to bust ass right here. Like, I have to make this run that I probably would not make with anybody else, not just on our team, but in any other situation in my career. I'm going to make this run and I'm going to have faith that the ball is going to find me. And not just find me, but put me in a position to essentially have a very straightforward goal scoring opportunity.
A 1v1 with the keeper, man.
It's just his his ability to conjure those moments is truly special. And then come on, the goal.
Let me just say, a few years ago, our friend Carlin Carpenter, who actually he works for Houston now, and a few other of the folks at American Soccer Analysis, did a really good series called Where Goals Come From. And they broke it down to the types of passes that lead to the highest quality chances. And it's why this like granular understanding of how goals are made is why so many teams now point their entire game model towards getting the ball to the sides of the boxes, what we call the Man City zones or the golden zone, the assist zone, for pullbacks across the six. Those are super high value. The highest value is off of through balls. And Messi per 90 this year is producing something like twice the number of through balls of any other player in MLS. Now, I don't have data for Ligue 1 or CONMEBOL World Cup qualifying or La Liga before that. I would guess that in those competitions as well, Messi produced through balls at twice the rate of any other player. It's because he sees moments like this. Anyway, I just wanted to shout out American Soccer Analysis again, because anytime Messi hits a pass like this, I think of that series and the work they did to really codify how the game at the highest level with the best players is played and how we should all aspire to play the game like that.
Did ASA manage to codify laser beams from the top of the box that don't spin and move at a pace?
That was from the Monterey branch of American Soccer Analysis.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. What a hit from Messi. What a hit. And what I love as well is his understanding of sort of the patience that he has. You know, sometimes you feel like players get into a spot and they're like, I'm here, I want the ball, give me the ball. And then they don't move from that spot when they don't get the ball. On Messi's goal, you see him just sort of understand, okay, here's this cascade of pressure coming to the ball, and I'm just going to, like, two or three times take three or four steps back. I'm going to remain engaged in the play. I'm going to remain available. I understand, okay, here comes the pressure. Here comes the pressure. But if there is just even a second for this ball to find my feet, I'm now standing in space. And that little touch from Messi, I feel like he has trademarked. The one with the outside of his left boot where he receives it, and he just kind of pushes it ahead two or three yards, whatever your measurement is. I'll hit up Atlanta United fans to let me know what the exact distance on that is. Ahead of him, and then you just know what's coming. He puts his head down. Tim Melia knows this is a shot. He is shooting. And womp. Like that, just womp. What a hit it was. Wonderful moment from Lionel Messi. But how about the game? Should we dig in a little more there? What happened to Kansas City? What's happening to them at home?
Turnovers. The midfield has not picked up where it left off last year, and neither has the back line. I think that's a big part of it. Another big part of it is Alan Pulido just not showing up at all. It's gotten so bad that Peter Vermees has actually switched his formation. They're playing a 4-2-3-1, and mm-hmm. Weeby, they've been a 4-3-3 team literally since 2009. And the idea is to get a little extra steel deeper in midfield. And that's not a bad idea for a team that's leaking goals, but it's asking Pulido to carry more weight than I think he's comfortable with in terms of playmaking. You know, there's a difference being a playmaker as a false nine versus being an out and out 10. And Pulido's being asked to play as an out and out 10. And a false nine, you get to pick and choose your spots where the game runs through you and then unlock things with a touch or two. You're not like the whole point of being a false nine is you're not at the center of things. You're popping up in unusual spots to dictate the game or to blow the game open, I should say. Whereas a 10, you have to be in all the reliable spots in order to dictate the game. And if you're not doing that, then the whole thing isn't going to function extremely well. Right now, it's not functioning extremely well for Sporting Kansas City. And I'm not sure there's an easy fix out there for this team, not unless they go out and they spend on a new DP before. Like, the transfer window is still open another week. The plan for Sporting Kansas City has been to bring in a new DP in the summer window. But by the time the summer window opens in mid-July, we're talking only like 10, 11 games left in the regular season. And it's starting to feel a little bit urgent that they address something before that.
Yeah, I agree and I disagree. The urgency, I'm less in agreement. I think you could do the summer window, but you can only do that if you stop dropping points at home in sort of embarrassing fashion. MLS is a league. Every league is a league. This is not some groundbreaking analysis here where home form is going to be what sort of eliminates contenders and pretenders, or separates, I should say. You know, the good teams will win home games, and then road form is sort of a bonus. The very best teams will be either good or just below sort of the 500 mark on the road, but most teams won't. Most teams will, you know, they'll just sort of survive there. But Kansas City right now is putting themselves in position to get 3 points at home on the regular. And not getting it. You know, a 3-0 blown lead to the Timbers, a 2-0 blown lead to the LA Galaxy, a 1-0 lead that dies in the final embers against Philadelphia Union, the 90+5. They're just all these instances of opportunities that a good team closes out that Kansas City aren't doing. And they've got to fix that part of it. And I don't know that that part of it has anything to do with Alan Pulido playing as a number 10 or as a false nine. I'm just not sure that it does. Now, what they are missing when in the chance creation sense is someone that can do something a little bit different out of midfield, and that's why Pulido's playing there. Like, Gadi Kinda was unpredictable. He could probe. He could get turned on somebody and carry the ball into dangerous positions. He could draw defenders because of the way that he was just elusive, and you didn't know exactly what he was going to do. Eric Tommy, you're pretty sure you know what he's going to do. He's direct. He's going to go to goal. Like, he had a great game, 2 goals here, and he'll remember that for the rest of his life. And I remain disappointed that he didn't get the jersey from Lionel Messi. But like, it's that little bit of like, uh-oh, now what's going to happen that Kansas City are missing in that area of the field, and that Peter's trying to get out of Alan Pulido. But he had one shot in this match. Like, you need Pulido to be both. You still need to be goal dangerous. I don't know. It's just not a snug fit right now. And I think without Gotti, that's taking away from the wings as well. Great game from Tommy, but like Daniel Shawley hasn't been as dangerous as he is at his very best. Johnny Russell's been having some fitness and injury concerns, and he hasn't been at that sort of sumptuous form that we came to expect from him from so many years. You know, a guy who could both do things that were incredible technically, but was also a bulldog 24/7. So there's some questions for Kansas City right now. It's not 2023 anymore.
Weeby, did you read the Peter Vermees quote that you gave us in the pre-show rundown? Do you have that? Do you have that handy?
Anders does, I think. Anders, help us, save us, come to our our rescue here. Before we get there, as he digs through, let's just answer this one about Miami. Are they Shield contenders? I heard you say that again in here.
Yeah.
And yeah, not just contenders. Let me edit that question. Are they Shield favorites?
If you gave me Miami against the field, I would take the field. If you gave me Miami and Columbus against the field, I would take Miami and Columbus. So I think they're in that tier. I think if the Galaxy could defend set pieces, they might be in that tier as well, but it's just such a glaring weakness they have. I think Vancouver have been playing really well, but are a piece short. I think the same is probably true for the Red Bulls. It's hard to look, every team in MLS has flaws, and Miami have some obvious ones. They're not a good defensive team right now. I don't think their center backs distribute the ball well enough to be truly dominant with the ball in the way that Busquets and Messi and Alba have always liked their teams to be dominant with the ball, because for the longest time, Barcelona was a dominant defensive team because they had 65% possession every single game. And that was, Busquets was a huge part of that, and Messi was a huge part of that, but so were the center backs, right? So were Mascherano and Piqué and you know, Puyol before that. It was all clockwork. Miami haven't come close to that yet, and they really appear to have downgraded it right back. So they have flaws. They're not going to run away with it, I don't think. But they have bigger and better answers than any other team in MLS history. If the Crew had already been knocked out, I would probably say the Crew are the favorites by a nose. But the Crew are going to play at least two more games. It's tough to point to Columbus in two more games in CONCACAF Champions Cup. I mean, it's tough to point to Columbus as having an advantage there. And it's hard to see anybody, like the Red Bulls don't score goals in games where they should score goals. And I know they've gotten better, but it's not a given, right? And I already mentioned the Galaxy's flaws, and LAFC are incomplete and will probably be incomplete until the summer window. Seattle haven't been great, even though the underlying numbers are good. And everybody has these things. I just think Miami have better answers.
Miami also have two games in hand on many and one game in hand on most. If you're looking at the standings right now from a Shield perspective, Miami, New York, and LA Galaxy all on 15 points, but there are 14 teams that are 15 to 11 points, and even more if you take that threshold down to 10. I mean, if you're talking about the Shield, even Atlanta, who just had a disappointing result at home, they've only played 7 games. They got 11 points. Let's say they get 4, they'd be right up there with Miami. I mean, this is going to be a dogfight, is what I'm trying to tell you. That nobody has separated themselves in any way. The concern I do have for Miami is just Messi's health and availability, right? We've already seen some variants to that, and we know there will be some in the summer with Copa America. They have the talent across the squad to make up for that, I think, in MLS. But again, that variance has been there from the jump for Miami. So here's the quote from Peter Vermees. Quote, "We lost the ball 3 times, and they just have that quality that when you do, they can punish you. There's a lot of games in MLS where you play back and forth. You play against other teams, and they give up some chances. You give up some chances. But at the end of the day, the quality they have, if you just look at the first goal, the pass that Lionel Messi makes, and then the second goal with the ball that he hits from where he hits it from, I think you would all agree that you don't see that regularly in MLS, and you do when you play against them. They can punish you, and that's what they did, but I thought we played very, very well. I really do. I really do. A little luck, and maybe it could have been a little bit different." Miami didn't have massive chances outside of the goals that they scored, but that goes to Peter Vermees' point. But also, I think, goes to my point, which is when you play Miami, there's a lot of things that can kill you, but the number one thing is Lionel Messi. And so, like Monterrey seemed to just gum up the spaces that he was in at all times and always have a body and always try a way to frustrate him. And I know Messi's coming out of, you know, he's not exactly in full strength. So in Monterrey, at altitude, a little bit different. But man, the amount of space that Messi had on both the pass and the goal, I don't know, I would be in the mindset of anybody else gets to kill me but Messi. And that still might not save you. In fact, it probably won't.
Mm-hmm.
But it's better odds than somebody else doing the things that Messi did against Kansas City, because that's top stuff that basically nobody else in the history of the game has been able to match.
I mean, that is a differentiator, but I think Suarez is probably the second best player in the league. They got Kramaski back as well. They have a guy who I still think is a very good goalkeeper in Drake Callender, and Julian Gressel's been a reliable secondary chance creator. So I think the with or without Messi, I'm not worried about their attack. I'm worried about can they be good and clean enough with the ball to dominate games and become a very good defensive team. And that seems a million miles away from happening right now. And that is, if they're not going to win the Shield, I think more than, you know, teams bracketing Messi or even Messi missing a little bit of time, I think it's the defensive concerns that'll be the reason why.
Who do you think wants the Shield the most?
I think Inter Miami want it the most. I think if you look at Messi's career, he's always put a premium on winning the league. He won 10 titles with Barcelona. He won, what, two more in Ligue 1 with PSG. He has always cared about play. And this is going to be a challenge for Tata Martino, because there are going to be games where Messi is like, I'm playing 90 minutes. And it's like, no, we're up 4-1. And we have another game Wednesday, and you're 36. You need to rest. And Tata Martino has to be able to take Messi and Suarez and maybe even Busquets off the field in those situations. But I think Miami wants it badly. Beyond that, I suspect we're a week or two from starting to hear talk about that from the Galaxy. Because Greg Vanney talked about it at the start of last season. Our goal is to win the Shield.
If I was Greg, I just wouldn't bring it up. That's an internal conversation, not a public conversation.
But it would be a look, the way they're playing right now, and it hasn't been great, but it has been really good in moments, and they have star power and the pieces fit. It feels like a way for the Galaxy to claw back would be to, I mean, you win a trophy, and this is the one that is kind of there for the taking, given the way the West has started to shake out over the first month and a half.
All right, let's talk Galaxy in the West. Vancouver at home, a big opportunity. We talked ad nauseum about this sort of soft schedule to start, and now the real test hits. Galaxy come into the building and win 3-1. Joe Pantel is very, very good. The timing of his runs is absolutely elite. And then once he gets on the ball, decision-making and then the technical side is obviously there. Who did this result say more about? To go back to that question I asked earlier about Atlanta and Philadelphia, but this time with a win and a loss. Say more about the Whitecaps or more about the Galaxy?
I think it says more about the Galaxy because this was a game. I don't think they win this game any season since 2014. They didn't play well. They gave up a lot of chances to the Whitecaps, and Brian White eventually got himself a goal, but I think there's about four other chances he would like to have back. But in years past, the Galaxy give up two chances like that, and they lose their minds, and they give up 10 more. Whereas in this game, they were able to sort of lock it down and be a little bit better defensively in the second half, and then be super opportunistic and eventually lethal going forward. And it's because the pieces fit, because Pantel and Gabriel Peck and Dejan Jovalich, they're perfect front runners ahead of Ricky Puig, who was the second best through ball artist in the league behind the guy we just talked about. So it's, I'm not going to say this is like, okay, the Galaxy are back, they're for real. But this is a huge result. Vancouver were playing really good ball. I would argue they actually did play really good ball throughout a good chunk of this game. They were atop the West standings, and the Galaxy went up there and they won by multiple goals. That is, when's the last time we would have seen that from an LA Galaxy team?
Speaking of that Puig pass, the Pantel goal, that has those, you know, Messi sort of, wait, where'd that ball come from? To who? Yeah. side. I mean, you looked at the Vancouver Whitecaps center backs and it split them, and they're sort of looking around like, wait, what? Like, there was a run happening there. There was an opportunity for that pass to be hit. Like, Brian White didn't finish, but the theme for the Whitecaps so far this year, I thought, looking at the numbers and talking to Vanni Sartini, had just been efficiency. It wasn't like they were creating voluminous chances so far. They were finishing just a lot of the opportunities they got, and they were very, very good on set pieces, not just the first ball, but in particular second phase. And they got a set piece goal in this game, so that trend continued both for them and for the LA Galaxy, who have now given up 7, I believe it is, off set pieces, which is, boy, an awful lot and has to be figured out. But a little bit more efficient from the Vancouver Whitecaps, and this is a different story. Here's Vanni Sartini on the last 20 minutes of the game. We've not been mature enough. We show that we can arrive in the box and score at any moment. We just need to defend well and keep our structure. We have to do the things we're supposed to do. We have to mark the space and not roam around and press and man mark and concede that second goal. That's the Ricky Pooge through ball. That is totally my fault, because when the team doesn't do what they're supposed to do, it's my fault at the end and we need to work at it. But it's a knife to my heart. It really is, because it's the worst way to lose, because it's all our fault. We need to know it's all our fault, because if we are 2-3 minutes just a little bit more patient and we defend well, we win. Not draw, we win. And I'm so pissed about it because of that. Vancouver don't need the ball. Like, in a lot of cases, they don't necessarily want the ball. They want space, Doyle. And that's where that patience comes in, because you allow the LA Galaxy to advance up the field without giving them the space to do the things that they did on that second goal. And for much of this year, Vancouver have been very good about that. Not overextending themselves, keeping their lines tight and compact. But then when they win the ball, being very intelligent and quick about the way that they break out in a direct way to create even numbers opportunities in their own space on the other side of the field. And I watched that playback, thanks to your column, as always, Monday mornings or Sunday nights, depending on when that thing goes up. Armchair Analyst is going to be on my phone in bed or wherever I'm at. I'm reading the whole thing. But yeah, you see them pressing, sort of pushing, trying to find an opportunity to go win the ball off a Galaxy team that's so good with the ball. And I wonder if a little bit of that is the wastefulness in front of goal. Hey, we've had all these opportunities. We've created all these chances. We haven't scored. So, okay, let's push. Let's go get the ball. Let's go find a way to get there again. And that's where the Galaxy can really tear you apart.
Yeah, and that's what we saw. And this comes back to, you know, the original question of this little segment is, did we learn more about LA or Vancouver? I don't think we learned about Vancouver. Just reiterated what we have been saying on this show for the past couple of years, which is they are one elite piece short. They don't have a Ricky Pooch. They don't have a guy at that level. I'm not sure they have a Paincel. I think that both Brian White and Ryan Gold are really, really good attackers in this league. I think, you know, Fafa Picot getting hurt and having to come off early didn't do them any favors in this one. But the Caps are just a really good team who lack top-end quality. And if ownership goes out and gets them a piece like that, then we could talk about Vancouver as a threat to win the Shield or MLS Cup. But I don't...
What's the piece?
I mean, I said last week it was, you know, if Pedro Vite can find another level, or two more levels, really, then maybe they don't have to go out and get a piece. But I do think it's a playmaker. I think it's a guy who can unlock things and let Gold play a little bit higher again, because I think he's been dropping in a lot, and be a goal scorer. And that takes pressure off of Brian White. But those guys tend to be very, very costly. And look, the Caps have been in MLS since 2011. They've only ever won one playoff game. In the past year and a half, between CONCACAF Champions League and Leagues Cup and the playoffs, they got 8 cracks at the best teams in the region. LAFC, Tigres twice, Club León. They won 0 of those 8 games. It's not the tactics, and it's not their player development, because they've done a really good job developing players, and they've done a really good job of finding undervalued guys like Brian White or Tristan Blackman. But like that can only get you so far.
Yeah, I mean, talking about the gap, Paincel and Pooge, are the two best just pure talent attacking players in this game by, I think, a pretty easy margin, just pure talent. You know, you can, I'm not talking about production, and I'm not talking about work ethic or any of those other things, just pure talent. On Paintsill, could he win MVP?
I don't think so. I mean, I love him, and I think he'll be best 11, but the MVP of that team is Ricky Pooch. And we all get caught up in his shortcomings. Like, he's still so tactically undisciplined. He'll drop too deep, and that breaks the Galaxy's entire shape. We saw it against LAFC last week. And, you know, he doesn't do much defensively and all that. But guys who can pass the ball like this, the one thing that connects everybody on the field in our sport is the ball. And Pooch is as gifted a connector with that ball as anybody we've ever had. Anybody we've had in this league, bar the guy in Miami, or maybe prime Valderrama. The thing is, if he was tactically disciplined, he wouldn't be here. He would be playing 90 minutes every week in Barcelona. But Pudge is the MVP of the Galaxy so far. Maybe that changes. I would be shocked if it did.
Speaking of doing special things with the ball, we've been waiting for that from CF Montreal. They've been on the road to start the season, finally got back to Stade Saputo, and the result was a 2-1 win against FC Cincinnati, who have some issues, which we'll talk about quickly in a second. But what did you see from Montreal in their first home match, Doyle? Matias Kokoro's hurt, which is sad. The mustache has to leave, but it's happy days because Josep Martinez comes on and scores and has an assist on a through ball, by the way, to Ariel Lassiter. What did you see tactically and from style of play when Montreal finally got home?
It was more what we had been kind of hoping for from Laurent Courtois in terms of using the ball. And the easiest way to illustrate that is in the six game road trip, they were averaging about 3.3 passes per sequence, which was down in the bottom third of all MLS teams. In this game, again, since a very good defensive side in Cincinnati, they averaged 3.9 passes per sequence, which would be fourth in the league over the course of the entire year, a tick ahead of Columbus. And that's what Courtois' roots are. He was a Columbus Crew 2 manager, and then he was assistant coach for the big team last year under Wilfried Nancy. They brought him to Montreal explicitly because of that, because they wanted to get back to playing with the ball. And look, you could see it on Joseph's goal, right? That was a Columbus Crew goal, because it was, okay, we win the ball very deep and we take our time building from the back to draw pressure up, to draw defenders up, create space, gaps between those lines. And the number eight, in this case, Matthew Choignet, he has to be brave and take that vertical space to provide an outlet rather than being conservative and sticking in front of the center backs in case there's a turnover. And that's the decision tree. That's what differentiates this team from so many, is the decision tree for the midfielders, even the deep-lying central midfielders, is do I play it safe or should I be bold? And it's almost always be bold. And by making that run, Matthew Choignet gets between the lines. Bryce Duke does a great job of checking his shoulder the entire time, plays one touch to him, and it's off to the races. And, you know, 6 seconds later, it's in the back of the net. That is just beautiful soccer. It's flowing, attacking soccer, getting, you know, from right to left, left to right. It starts at the center backs, multiple touches, nothing is hurried. It's what we had been hoping to see, and it speaks really well of what's to come, that they pulled it off in their first home game against a really, really good team. And I think that Montreal fans, judging by my replies on social media, Montreal fans are flying this morning.
I thought Bryce Duke had a really nice game here, one of the best games he's had for Montreal. The thing I would say about this team and about that style of play, and certainly we see it with the Crew as well, is you need to have guys sort of fill lanes once you break that pressure and able to go quickly. And that's where certainly wingbacks come into play, but also your forwards and guys that can get a little bit more vertical and then have also just that hammer that drops in as well. And Josep Martinez at times dropped in and was the guy who received the ball in the half space and then had a run ahead of him. And then Juan and Raheem Edwards, I thought, had great games as well. Edwards' cutback ball to Josep in the box is really, really spot on, and Juan just remains a constant threat up and down that right flank. I think if you look at the, this is a guess, I'm just going to venture a pure guess. If you looked at average position, Huon might be on average the furthest player forward. Like he is just all, and this is what you see with the crew too. He's just always sitting on that line, on that defensive line, waiting for the moment when you shift and now he's in acres of space, or just to keep you a little bit more honest, create more space in between for through balls between that line. It's interesting to have one game of data. We need more. Where do you think Montreal's ceiling is and the expected finish, the two, those two sides of the coin? I said on wrap up, was asked by Liam McHugh, can this be a top four team? I said, yes, their ceiling can be top four. I know they don't have the same level of quote-unquote elite talent that a lot of the other teams in the East might have, but they have very good players, and they have a true differentiator in the style of play, and literally nobody would have thought 2022 Montreal would finish where they finished.
I mean, that's a really good point. I still think four feels a little bit high. I could see them ceiling.
That's the ceiling.
I could see it happening for, I don't think top three, but I could see them sneaking into the four slot. I tell you what, I would be absolutely shocked if this is not a playoff team. This looks like a team that, you know, anywhere from 6, 7, 8, write it down in pen. And this probably is a closer team, to six.
They than made the eight. Playoffs. They almost made the playoffs last year, winning 8 points on the road.
That's
they
a
were
point.
A decision day break away. And this year they've already got 7 on the road. And are going to play now 16 more home games because they've only played one and they won it against the Shield defenders. I'm going to put it down in Sharpie. Like, I'm going to jail for God, why can't I think of the name? Never mind. That didn't work. We're just going to walk away here. All right. How about Cincinnati? Two different emails here. New formation needed, says Dylan D. Is the 3-5-2 dead? What can be done to right this ship? And Anthony Isaac's come back. Cincinnati isn't playing well, and I don't care. This is a very good group with a very good coach. They will figure it out, and it'll be a fun run through the playoffs.
Yeah, I lean more towards the second. I think that Pat Noonan and this, you know, a good chunk of this group of players has some equity with us, and I think that the defense will continue to stay at a high level, and that will keep the floor high. But the ceiling's not particularly high right now because – you know, Aaron Bupenza has disappointed. Yuya Kubo is now starting over Corey Barrett, and Yuya Kubo's a useful player, but he's not a starting forward in this league. Lucho Acosta has not been able, like, he's still Lucho, he's still really good, but he's not doing that MVP stuff.
Well, I mean, they took away his relationships, Doyle.
Yeah, for sure.
That's what it's all about. It's Barrial and the way that, you know, Vasquez could create space for him to both run into himself, but also to advance the ball and pass into. Like, those things really matter. They didn't take him away. I should not say it that way. They just changed, and they're not as strong as they once were.
And it makes you wonder if things had been different, right? If Cincinnati had been able to match the salary that Monterey offered for Brandon Vasquez, and if he was still in Cincinnati, you know, would Cincinnati be the team that is into the CONCACAF Champions Cup semifinals?
We'll never know. Portland 2, LAFC 2. Evander is an absolute stone-cold baller. Phil Neville says he's basically the best 10 in the West and maybe even the league. Like, let's take Messi out of that. By the way, Jonathan Rodriguez back at the left wing. Felipe Mora up top. Mora got a goal by the skin of his teeth, but a beautiful pass from Evander to set that one up. And this game was sort of marked by a bad red card for Maxime Crépeau. And then a call late on, Nathan Ordaz called for a foul that I just didn't think was a foul on Kamal Miller. Otherwise, Timothy Tillman would have scored the winner. Let's see, Evander or Mateusz Bogusz? Who you want to give time to?
Let's give time to Mateusz Bogusz because I in particular, but I think you've probably mentioned a few times as well, it's weird that he's a gifted young midfielder who's being forced to play as a false nine. And it's been very, very false for him up until this point, which is by way of saying that he has not created danger along the front line. He just hasn't been able to do it consistently at all. And then that is compounded by the fact that LAFC are a team that don't want the ball. So you have a midfielder playing as a false nine coming in to create possession in midfield for a team that doesn't really want possession. None of it has made sense, but Bogusz play like he scored a Bradley Wright Phillips goal today, like 100%. This weekend. You know, it was really smart understanding of where the space was, and then one touch with the left, and then one touch with the right, or one touch with the right, one touch with the left. Strong finish across his body, back post. That was a pure striker's goal. So you could say, based upon that, that he's learning the spot. And I thought he was dangerous at other times as well.
As for Evander, the way he plays is languid, like in the best possible way. The rhythm, the tempo, the unhurried nature. I mean, we keep saying the same things about him, but he keeps scoring goals and dishing out assists in the same ways. The goal in particular, how you can look so calm, unhurried, and casual, taking a ball off your chest like that, popping it up into the air, and then volleying it into the roof of the net is astounding. But the highlight reel that he is putting together is incredible. Now, for Portland, they need that highlight reel to continue. They need consistency at that level from him, because it sort of feels like the rest of what they're doing is not as spectacular. But I think that's a conversation for another day, and Phil Neville is certainly grinding to try to get that figured out and get it to be a little bit more where he wants it to be. How about DC United in Orlando? Orlando, Cardiac Cats, they're back, baby. Yeah. Big comeback-ish? No, not back? What do you think?
No, I mean, they did a good job of creating chances, especially once it got to the tactics free zone. I think the fact that Cesar Araujo and Wilder Cartagena were back in central midfield starting together, looking mostly fit, that is a huge plus for them. Oscar Pereja decided to play Facu Torres as the 10 and Martin Ojeda as the inverted right winger. I don't get that. I know Facu Torres has said repeatedly that he wants to play inside. He's more comfortable inside, but he's less effective because he's not the type of guy who sees that final pass. He's really good at combining. He's really good at picking spots to be a secondary playmaker or a secondary goal scorer. And when he can play that role, we saw last year. I mean, he's in the Uruguay national team for a reason. And it's not to play as a number 10, man. Whereas Ojeda, I mean, he's a guy who does, for all his faults, and he has a lot, he's a guy who does see that last pass. That said, they created chances. They scored three goals. They have Duncan McGuire off the bench, and that worked. And this was a huge result for them. And we said it last week that this time last year it was bad for Orlando City as well, and they eventually figured it out. I'm not sure that I would be surprised if they ended up on 63 points, but they're going to make the playoffs.
DC got to figure out how to hold on to leads, hold on to results.
It's pretty grim.
I mean, this is for everything that they've done well, and they've done a ton well. I think Troy Lesane and what he's integrated and built very quickly in terms of style of play is very, very impressive. But yeah, there's some, not wheels falling off, but definitely some nuts getting a little bit loose here. What is it, one win in seven games for them? And the goal is certainly, like, if you're going to be a team that tries to control real estate, you can't let another team play out quite that easily into all the space behind you. So some tape to look at for Troy Lesane and DC United. Coach of the Year. Very early, extremely early, far too early, and that will never, ever stop us, Matt Doyle. We've got some candidates here. Dean Smith would be a candidate, big 3-2 win for Charlotte at home against Toronto. Their home form is very good, and Leo Labada got a goal, so that's a nice start from them. He looked very dangerous in this game. Thought he should have had another goal, but it was called off for a foul on the set-piece routine. Didn't agree with that one, but yeah, another win for Charlotte. How about Sandro Schwartz? 0-0 at home against Chicago. Andres Reyes and both in the Fire saved themselves from a That's Whack segment, because there's a lot of other whackness, but this was whack from both. Reyes with just a terrible decision, violent conduct before a set piece, throws his hand up into the face of a Fire defender with force, and you're going to get sent off every time. And the Fire, up a man, generate basically nothing of danger and probably should have lost to this Red Bulls team. Then we also have, as a candidate here, both Pablo Mascherini, who's got his team rising up the table, and Wilfred Nancy, of course, a 0-0 draw between those two teams in Rio Tinto. No, not Rio Tinto anymore, America First. And then Ben Olsen. 2-1 win on the road for the Houston Dynamo against Minnesota United. And I'm going to save the debate here. We're both going to say Ben Olsen is right now the favorite for Coach of the Year, and by a pretty significant margin.
if you had told me that this team was going to be up near the top of the Supporter Shield race on both points and points per game, despite not having Hector Herrera for most of the first 2 months of the season, despite not adding a third DP, despite having to bring Sebas Ferreira back and having him injured. I mean, yeah, it's Ben Olsen in a walk. And to his credit, right, they have been able to do it a couple different ways. And we saw it this way. Like, this was an old school Dynamo performance where they went on the road and they got absolutely smashed and somehow came away with all 3 points. They haven't done that a lot in the past decade, but they used to. We should have Kalen on for that segment. But for the
you think you can talk about it through the tears?
For the most part this year, they've been playing the same type of ball that they played last year, which is ball dominant. They do it a little bit differently than Columbus. They don't build from the back near, like, they don't involve the center backs as much as they do a million passes through midfield. Even without Hector Herrera, they've been able to do that and be really good at it. And we haven't seen it show itself in attack as much because right now they're playing their number 10 as a false nine and they don't really have a center forward on the team. But
is Kowalczyk, is Kowalczyk a number 10? He's more of an eight. I don't even know if he's a 10.
Well, I mean, he and Bossy have been alternating between false nine and 10, and it's absurd. It shouldn't work, but it's working.
Amin Bossy has been wonderful. Koko Karaskia has been absolutely incredible. And Kowalczyk is still sort of figuring out how to play and what his best position is, and understandably so, because they're just having to rotate. But good Lord, that goal, Doyle.
Yeah.
The Meg and the finish, you can see it in his face. He's just like, I think, to me, he was saying, that's not necessarily the norm here, and I'm going to really enjoy this moment.
It has been, look, what the Dynamo did last year shocked us. So maybe we shouldn't be as shocked as we are that they're doing it this year, but I really thought Ache was the straw that stirred the entire drink, and I thought it was going to fall apart without him. And the fact that it hasn't is a credit to those players, but it's a huge credit to Ben Olsen. It's absolutely huge credit to Ben Olsen as a manager.
One of the best defensive teams in the league by the numbers. I mean, when you expected goals allowed, everything else, like, they are top three in that category. Use the ball, yes, to create opportunities, but not in like some crazy volume. Like, their chance creation is bottom of the Western Conference on expected goals. But they just don't give you opportunities, and they control games and the state of the games with the ball, and they're doing it, as you said, without the guys that we thought were the key to doing that. Ben Olsen, Houston Dynamo, absolutely killing it. Congratulations to them and their start. And that means we have to go the opposite direction into the land of whackness. Let's start with Minnesota. Emilio Reynoso, when he goes to Argentina, yeah, just can't get him back. He's not coming back. News came out this week. Emilio Reynoso missed his green card appointment. And that had been the word. Hey, he's okay. He's going to be back. Everything's good. He's just in Argentina getting his green card. Well, he missed that appointment. And now hasn't had another appointment. Does have some personal issues going on. We've heard from the organization many times about that. I won't read the full statement that came out. You can go find that at MLSsoccer.com or the Minnesota United website or on their Twitter account. But that for the first time, that statement about Reynoso, even after he didn't show up till May last year, had even just a little bit of bite to it, Doyle. Of just like, hey, we're focused on the guys here, and that's what we're thinking about. Not our number 10, not our DP, not the guy that, you know, had brought the magic for us for so many years now. I don't know how you continue with him in the team.
I don't think you do. And it bums me out because he's been so much fun to watch when he's been here and been healthy and been bought in. And by all accounts, he's a great guy. Like, yeah, everybody, everybody there
for sure
likes him, but he's clearly troubled off the field. And look, we talked about it on the show a bunch. We didn't know how he was going to fit with the type of system that Eric Ramsey seems to want to install. Well, he's taken the decision out of the coach's hands. And over the last year, there's been very little difference in their points per game with Reynoso and without Reynoso. I think there's a little bit of noise in that, but we saw it this weekend. Like, Minnesota didn't have any trouble creating chances. Like, that has been like, this team has not struggled creating chances this year. And if they're not struggling creating chances, that diminishes the urgency of getting Reynoso back and diminishes the need of living with his baggage. And it stinks because for the past 5 years, he was one of my favorite players in this league to watch. But I at this point, I find it hard to imagine he'll ever play for Minnesota again.
The sad thing, too, is this was the second chance he probably needed, right? Like, you had the first one, and boy, that was strange, but he got back, and he played well, and it was like, okay, now there's a new regime. There's a new CSO. Khalid El-Ahmad is in. You have an opportunity. You have a new coach in Eric Ramsey to impress and to be a part of this project. You have a blank slate. Maybe not with the fan base, maybe not with the organization as a whole, but with the people that directly decide your role, your place on the team now and in the future. And like, the first thing that you do is you leave and you don't come back. Yeah, it's just hard. It's hard to trust. I don't know. It's very hard to trust that, even if it's a good person, that like, man, if you're not here, are you going to be back when you say you are? And that would seem to me to be sort of like a foundational part of paying a person a lot of money. And basing your team and your expectation and your plans either in the short or medium or long term around that person. So, boy, we'll see what happens. We hope for Emmanuel Reynoso on just a personal level. You know, despite my opinion that I don't think they can really, that this can't continue, like the project and the relationship between the two sides. You hope for him on a personal level that everything's okay, and that he's not in a place that, you know, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know what the situation is, but not in a place that emotionally or physically or whatever it is bad for him. So, all right, let's talk about bad results. That's a little more straightforward, right? San Jose, 7 losses, 1 win in 8 games. At home against Colorado Rapids. I know you slandered the Rapids up and down. Their fan base is furious with you, but it's a bad loss. 3-0. Can things get worse?
I mean, they have, I think, 4 of their next 5 on the road.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah. And they're down to their third string goalkeeper. And not that Daniel was great when he was available this year, but that's a concern. The new center backs have not been good. Carlos Guerrero is not often available, and when he has been available over the past year plus, he hasn't been particularly great. I don't see a way up the ladder for this team this year. I just don't.
Oh, well, I'm just going to leave it there because I don't, you know, like, we have other whackness to get to, and this one's pretty blindingly obvious. On the Rapid side, let's just give them a few flowers here because they are 5th in the Western Conference, and the expected goal differential per 90 says that that's about right. Mm-hmm. And it seems like Chris Armas is getting a good amount out of this team. Even if the opponent on this night was not the best, give me one thing that you're impressed by. What's the one thing that you would hang your hat on right now if you're the Rapids?
So when they lost Connor Ronan, I thought they were going to lose their ability to play with the ball. And they haven't. And Oliver Larraz has been, I think, pretty good filling in. He's a homegrown kid. And then, Cole Bassett dropping back a level, cause he was going to be a pressing 10. To start the year, and he was a pressing 10 to start the year. Cole Bassett dropping back a level has been super dynamic on both sides of the ball and been fun to watch. And a guy like that with that kind of engine just makes it really tough to sort of cover all your bases in trying to contain this team. And so they can explode offensively in a way that we haven't seen from Colorado Rapids for a long time. I had a little fun on Twitter saying that, like, the 3-0 loss to the Rapids, all caps, is rock bottom for San Jose, and Rapids fans took umbrage at that. But this was a win, a road win by 3+ goals. This has happened only one time in the past decade for the Colorado Rapids. And that time, the losing coach immediately got fired. So like this is a different level of attacking flexibility and proficiency. Now, I think what is going to be interesting to see, interesting is such a bad word, but I'm going to go with it, is whether Rafa Navarro can sort of roll forward from this 2-goal game and start being dangerous from the run of play. Mm-hmm. That is, like, he's supposed to be a DP center forward. He has not been up to that level. If he can, start scoring a goal every other game, something like that from here on out, then the Rapids they're going to be cooking. But it's still a bunch of ifs that we're stacking on this team. I think that I understand the exuberance from mm-hmm. Rapids fans. Mm-hmm. And you should, anytime you get a big win like this, you should celebrate.
Cling to that.
Absolutely. But there's a lot of questions that need to be answered.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, interesting is a bad word. You don't like unique, but Hafa Navahu has a unique way of saying his name. And that was a good way of me to get in that unique thing that seems to rankle you, Doyle. If Dave's not here to do it, I got to do it. I would call out, did you call him Mois Bombito in there?
I did not, but the man has a Jaimison Olave like recovery speed.
Yes, there is something brewing with Bombito. He's in the Canadian national team now. He's not exactly young, though. He's drafted ahead of last season. He's 24 years old. But again, we always talk about, like, oh, where do you get center backs in this league? Lots of good ones come out of the draft. Might be worth scouting those guys and picking the right one. Looks like a guy who could be a contributor for a long time for the Rapids and certainly in Major League Soccer. One question on the Quakes. I'm sorry, I have to take it back to this. MLS Gone Wild hit us up and said the Quakes are on pace to set the MLS record for most goals conceded in a 34-game season. They're at 2.5 goals per game through 8 matches. For context, all for Cincy. Cincinnati set the record in their expansion season, allowing 75. I believe it was in 2019, and that was 2.2 goals per game. So that's a bad sign.
It's a very bad sign. I don't think that San Jose are that bad. I think that they, and the underlying numbers certainly aren't as bad as Cincinnati's were their first 3 years in the league. So I would be surprised if they didn't figure this out to some degree. But this is, I mean, they have 3 points from the first 24 on offer. Like, this is not a playoff team.
New England lost again, this time in New York City. New York City FC with a 2-0 win. Congratulations to Agustin Ojeda, his first start and his first goal. Well done there, but the Revs are in the whack zone right now, and Caleb Porter said, hey, we've got to figure this out. It's been a bad start for us. They have had a complicated schedule, but yeah, the rubber's got to hit the road at some point. Like, Sporting Kansas City might have been bad for 10 games last year, but then they went on a hell of a run, and it was pretty unique in MLS context that they were able to do that. So New England, you got to get it going. Dallas and Seattle, 0-0, also not getting it going. There's some whackness to go around there. And we finish here in the mailbag. Jackson hit us up and said, broad question for you guys. How much better has the league gotten in the last 10 to 15 years? As an RSL fan, I wonder how our teams circa 2011-13 would do today, or where Prime Raimondo would rank among current MLS goalkeepers. But the question applies to the whole league.
So in a one-off, I still think that team would be able to compete. That was a really well put together team, that RSL one. And I think if you go back to like the early DC United teams, those teams would still be good in a one-off or a best of three. The real difference is the zero depth compared to what we have now. And I think in general, players 5 through 15 are much better. And then players 16 through 24, which gets you through an entire season and multiple there's no comparison to what it was 15 years ago. Like, those roster slots basically didn't exist.
I would argue 1 through 5 too, just on level of investment, experience, and overall talent. I mean, I just think, and also volume. You know, you're just talking also about how many of those players are in the league, just based on how many teams there are.
For sure. The rejoinder I would make is that certain all-timer teams like Dom Kinnear's Dynamo or the Jason Kreis era RSL team, they basically had DPs, right? Like Javier Morales, the team was a star. No, Javier Morales is a freaking star. Javier Morales was one of the all-time best chance creators in this league. If we dropped him into MLS today in his prime, he would still be awesome. Mm-hmm. Kyle Beckerman was a DP level D mid. Jaimison Olave might still be the best imported center back we've ever had in this league. Sabo, I think for 100 games he has, if for any player with more than 100 games played, he's like among the league leaders in ever in goals per 90, and he did it during the era in which goal scoring in MLS was at its absolute lowest.
Yes,
right. So I think across the league there are more teams with more good players, but I still think the best teams from that era could compete on like a small scale over the course of the season. Injuries would take their toll in a much more significant way than what we see with our teams now, just because there's more money to go out and get good players. And I think there are more smart front offices than there used to be.
All right, that's it for us. Let's call it good on match day 9. Big thanks to you, Doyle, for hanging here with me. We'll be back on Thursday to lead you into match day 10 and hit some of the biggest stories around the league. Enjoy your week, everybody. As always, hit us up if you got questions, takes, or prompts. Adios.